this week in Sunday Times, reading a story which I never knew. Rape crisis, encouraging women who are victims of abuse, sex-based violence, telling them to avoid going to a police station, but instead calling on them to seek help at hospitals, where they can then be put in touch with a GBV survivor-sensitive staff member to spare them the ordeal of secondary trauma. We know that charge officers at our police stations are not the most friendliest of environments. Now imagine if you are a victim of sex-based violence. And yes, there's been a great effort over the last few years to provide counseling and trauma rooms for victims of sex-based violence, but we're not seeing that being fully implemented. And it's something that I didn't know of victims of violence being told, rather go to a clinic or hospital, because there they would be obligated to assess you and then to call a relevant police officer who would be trained and would then take your case, hear your story in a sensitive manner. GBV researcher at the University of Johannesburg, Lisa Vetten. Of course, I know that charge officers aren't the most welcoming of places. But your thoughts on victims of sex-based violence in particular, to say, rather not go to the police station, rather go to a hospital where you'll receive the adequate medical treatment and assessment, and then they will have to call someone who would be trained to deal with your case. It seemed almost quite obvious.
It is obvious, and it has been the case for decades, actually. When the very first Tutuzela Care Center was set up in 2000 in Manenberg, the idea was to have police officers stationed on site in order to prevent somebody having to go to the police station and then go to the Tutuzela Care Center. And you can even find some of the very earliest examples, you know, following democracy in 94, we're experimenting with exactly that in order to spare somebody having to go to the police station. Mm. So it's a very, very old recommendation that people perhaps have forgotten and I think has perhaps not always worked as well in practice. Because, of course, one very clear problem is that specialized hospital services in the form of the TCC, for example, there are only 55 in the country. So what do you do if you are in a small town or you are 300 or 400 kilometers away from the nearest TCC? So it's a recommendation that works under some circumstances, but not all.
Why is it? I know that over the last 2 years, there has been an impetus from national government in addressing legislation, in providing more resources to care centers. There's been already, I think, two bills that have already been published and making its way through Parliament. But when we're looking at care centers, why is it that many victims of violence, I don't know it. I feel myself I'm a fairly knowledgeable person around areas of media, public health and policing and law, but I don't necessarily know what to do if someone that I know is a woman that I know is a victim of sexual violence.
I suppose there are two reasons for that. You know, in an ideal world, most of us are not going to live in expectation of being harmed and therefore in preparation for that, sit down and swat up on everything that needs to happen. Mm. So, I mean, I think it's quite reasonable that people wouldn't know this. What is much more of a concern, though, is when people who should know it give out the incorrect information. Yeah. For instance, I was listening to somebody on television about a month ago complaining by saying that the police don't give women protection orders, they send them to court. That's correct. That is the law. Mm. So it's very concerning when people who supposedly work in this field give out the incorrect information. Mm. But I think it's also a challenge to think about, well, why are we using the wrong vehicles to reach people? Mm. What are we doing that's wrong? Because I must say, everything that the government has done in the last 2 years is not new. Mm. All of it's been in place, some of it since the 1990s, some of it in the early, in the 2000s. Mm. It's all been there. And the question is, why was it allowed to decay in some instances, and why did people not know it existed and how to use it? And also, why have we not built on and developed what does look like it's promising and could actually be better than what we currently have? What we seem to have done over the last few years is just reinvent the same things. So, for instance, the amendments to the law, well, they just extend the sexual offences register, make bail more difficult, and in some instances extend the length of sentences. We've been doing that since 1997. It hasn't made a wonderful difference, except the size of the prison population.
Lisa, in every turn, whether it be systematically, whether it be a feeling of guilt, whether it be people discouraging you, whether it be hearing previous stories of not receiving care and attention at police station, women are discouraged in general to go and report. But if we look at, for example, what we've been doing in terms of missing people, we've always had this idea, oh, you must wait 24 hours to report a missing person. That is now largely be dispelled, and police have gotten into this, no, don't wait, come now. What are some of the tools that we could use to like what we've done with missing people, don't wait 24 hours, to make it easier, more accessible, and also victim-centered for particularly women to go report sex cases, sex violence?
I think it's important that we distinguish between sexual violence and domestic violence, because the two are dealt with differently in law. So I think, you know, sometimes when we use the term GBV, we collapse those distinctions, and I think that potentially also adds to the confusion. So, for instance, everybody should know that in the case of a rape, you can go directly to the hospital. Not only that, you don't even need to have reported the rape to the police in order to be receive medical treatment, including post-exposure prophylaxis to prevent HIV. That we must tell everybody, and they must know that. That's different to a case of domestic violence. In a case of domestic violence, unless you've been injured, it will not help you to go to a hospital at all. Then you should emphatically go to the police, and in fact, you can even call them out to your home. So I think it's important that we start distinguishing between these different kinds of violence and explaining this is what you do under this situation, this is what you do under that situation. You know, some of the standard things that people can do are, you know, short little, possibly won't even put them out over Twitter, little 5 points around what to do, little spots on the radio, reaching broadly around what can be done. And maybe to also pick up on your other point, is you're quite right. I think if we only focus on what's negative, it is discouraging. And I think it also perhaps discourages those who do try and make a difference. And it's important possibly that we also highlight those who, with the same limited resources, the same inadequate training, are nonetheless making a difference. And I'm going to give you an example from some research we did recently looking at the police's ability to act on the law. Some police stations, it's their duty to refer women to the shelters. Some of them didn't know what a shelter was. They needed an explanation, so they couldn't refer. But we called other police stations, and they didn't know that we were researchers. We just phoned them up and said, we're seeking help. We would like the details of a shelter. And some police stations, and I'm happy to since it's your audience, we're in the Western Cape, actually could give the name of the closest shelter, could tell you the name of the house mother and who to ask for when you called, and not only that, still phone the following day to check if the researcher had gotten help. That's fantastic. That's what you would like the police to do. So I think it's also quite useful to look at how do we acknowledge those. Like, I mean, there's some wonderful doctors in the 24/7 Tutuzela care centres. That we also acknowledge them and talk and hear from them what it is that they do to make a difference. Because clearly they can. And it's useful to be reminded of that and not just those who don't do their job. So I think if we did different things, it could help.
Lisa, and the more I hear and the more I listen, and the more I think of the process of reporting a sexual assault, the more I think about secondary trauma, not just by dealing with uncaring state officials who already have a workload of themselves. I am thinking about the secondary trauma in terms of finding the forensic evidence, I'd like you to speak about that, because that must be almost a secondary violation which someone would have to go through after being violated in the first place. I can't begin to imagine what that secondary violation of one's body, although it will largely help possibly in the legal case that now has to take place. Explain some of that in some of the people that you've spoken to.
Sure. So, I mean, I think where there's been a delay, say, of 5 days or more in reporting, then you don't put somebody through a forensic examination because it's completely unnecessary. So forensic examinations become important when if you report immediately after a rape incident or another kind of sexual assault. I think what's important is, if possible, to go to a specialized facility, and hopefully there is one that exists. And here is where it becomes really important to look at the training of those who are providing this. Now, we often have the assumption that doctors are better than nurses. And in fact, I think in this instance, forensic nurses who have been trained are better than doctors. Mm. And there's a big gap, I think, in our university education. Not enough universities who offer medical degrees are training their students in how to do an examination and interact in a compassionate and caring manner with complainants. Mm. So I think that's a very important area of intervention, is to start making this compulsory within university education. We've also got to start recognizing forensic nursing as a specialty and as a degree, so that we can have more nurses employed within facilities, because their examinations are of a better quality and they are better equipped to be able to go and testify in court. Mm. So that's a very simple and easy intervention we could be making. I mean, I think when somebody has been trained, they do know how to conduct the examination in a way that, firstly, you know, you can have situations where somebody won't even look you in the eye while they do the examination. They just head straight to the genital region, do the examination, ask you a few questions, and that's it. Whereas somebody introduces themselves, explains what they're doing. I think when we do training, what we often suggest to trainee or your medical interns is that, you know, before you do something, tell somebody, this is what I'm going to do next, and this is why I'm doing it. Because people are better able to manage difficult experiences if they're told why this is being done. So if you explain that and prepare someone, say, are you ready now for me to insert X or Y, then it gets better. So there are ways in which it can be made less unpleasant.
I find the term rape kit far too blunt. It is a reminder of the person undergoing an assessment. We are going to do this thing that was done to you, and we're calling it a rape kit. I think there are different words which can be used to describe this very physical and obtrusive thing that medical staff would need to do for you to compile this case against your attacker.
Yes, I mean, the correct name is the Sexual Assault Evidence Crime Collection Kit, which is a bit of a mouthful, which is probably why it ends up as rape kit. But possibly if you called it an evidence kit, that would help, because that's exactly what it is. Mm. That might be helpful. And of course, in every instance, you're not necessarily going to need it. Mm. Because in a situation where, for instance, you've been, the rape has been committed by your partner. In that instance, their defense is not going to be, it was a stranger, I never did it. Their defense is going to be consent. So in that instance, you can say, do I need to necessarily go the full hog and collect forensic specimens when that is not going to be the defense? The defense is going to be one of consent. And under those circumstances, I'm going to be looking for different injuries. For instance, bruising where I might have been hit, or self-defense injuries if I might have tried to hit back. And, you know, you do that rather than necessarily. Mm. And I think the same goes with the forensic evidence. You know, given the problems we have with kits, it might be that the priorities are those which are stranger rapes, where identity is in dispute, rather than those where the defense is going to be consent. And those you might merely want to analyze in order to be able to build up a DNA database.
In this very broad and hard conversation, someone reminds us, saying, yes, Lester, talking about women is important, but imagine how this is exacerbated for children, especially when you're talking about assessments. And that's something that we wouldn't even want to begin to imagine, to even talk about. How do you even, and any information could help people in the future. How, as a parent, do you then be there with your child and also tell them and comfort them and say, this is a doctor, this is a nurse who's going to look at you now? How do you even broach that?
You know, I do think there does need to be special training for doctors, and they do struggle. In fact, I would say much of the criminal justice system does struggle with younger children because it's a system that was designed for adults. Mm. So, generally speaking, it's extremely important for all those who work in the sector to have training for dealing with younger children, how to talk to them, how to explain to them, how to reassure them, and having a parent there can be incredibly helpful. I think giving them a toy or something to hold can also be extremely helpful. You know, one often finds toys, rooms, equipment that is at the side, you know, little tables and chairs and other things that are at a child's size. If you make the environment child friendly, it can be a little bit more manageable. And it's also, I think, really important, and this sounds easy, and I'm sure it's not easy in practice, it's also really important for parents to try and remain calm, because if they're agitated and upset, that communicates itself to their child. So it is important that one try and help them to be strong through that.
Well, Lisa Vetten, thank you so much. Helpful and educational, as always. Really appreciate your time here on The Morning Review.
Thank you.